Acts chapter 27. Paul was arrested on his visit to Jerusalem and ended up sitting in jail in Caesarea, which is down the hill. He ended up sitting in jail for 2 years waiting for a fair trial. Finally, when it looked like he was not going to get a fair trial, he used his right as a Roman citizen to appeal to Rome. And so off he's going to Rome. Chapter 27, verse 1. And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius. I don't know if he liked oranges or not. He was orange, Julius. That was the color of his robe. I'm sorry. Unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus's band. Just a couple of notes. Note that Paul is not the only prisoner on this ship. There's other prisoners. Some may be, like Paul, those who have appealed to Rome. Some may be on their way to Rome for a fair trial. Probably, more likely than not, most of them are the kind that are condemned to death and heading for the gladiator games to entertain the citizens of Rome. That's probably what most of these folks are heading for. But Paul's not the only prisoner. Keep that in mind. That'll help have stuff make sense as we're going through it. They're entrusted to a guy named Julius, who is a centurion. A centurion is one who is over 100 men of the Augustan band. This was one of Caesar's set of elite troops. Verse 2, and entering into a ship of Adramyttium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coasts of Asia, one Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. Now, when they get to, Caesarea is a port along the coast of Israel, and we'll see. I'm curious how this map's going to show up, because it's awfully small to get the whole thing in. Can you even see that? Not too bad. They're going to start the journey here in Caesarea. They get a ship from Adramyttium. Adramyttium is up here on the coast just south of Troas, up in what we call Asia Minor or modern Turkey. And they're going to, let's see, we're experimenting for service. How am I going to do this? Well, I'll leave this on, run back and forth, we'll see. They launched, meaning to sail by the coasts of Asia. In other words, this is a smaller ship. We've already seen with some of Paul's other travels, there's two sizes. There's your short hop, short excursion ships, and then there's a monster 747 ships that sail across the ocean blue. They're on a smaller one. Their intent is to hop, skip, and just stay close to the coastline as they're making their way west. So they hop a ship from Caesarea, and along for the ride is Aristarchus and his being with us. We're assuming that Luke is a part of this. So there's at least three guys going. There's Paul, there's Luke, and Aristarchus. You can read about Aristarchus in Acts 19:29 and Acts 24:20, verse 4. He's one of Paul's regular traveling companions. Verse 3, and the next day we touched at Sidon, 65 miles up the coast. That was a good day of sailing, 65 miles in one day. And Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. The word courteously in the Greek, it's where we get our word philanthropic. You're going to see Julius treat Paul with total respect. He's going to be nothing but kind to Paul all the way through this trip. And he gives him liberty. He says, oh, go visit your friends. You've got some friends here inside, no problem. Go visit with them. And so they're ministering to Paul. Verse 4, when we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus because the winds were contrary. Now, this time of the year, we believe this is around July, August or so, the winds blow from the northwest. Okay? So to go, see, from Caesarea to go this way, you can't do it. You're going against the wind. So that's the reason why they'll be going north, attacking along the coast. And then in this area along here, they'll have the shore to hide them from the wind, from the main winds that are blowing. And so because of that, that's why they're going this way around, because the winds are against them. Verse 5, "And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia." So Myra is over here, and they're going through, the Cilicia is this area here, Pamphylia is this area here. So they're going through the seas, they end up in Myra. Myra was one of the main airport hubs of that day. This is one of the main trading cities. This was a place where a lot of the big giant 747 jumbo grain cargo carriers jumped off from. It was a main port that connected actually Alexandria, which is down here in Egypt, one of the second biggest city in the empire. So they end up in Myra, city of Lycia. And there, the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. He finds one of these big jumbo 747, jumbo cargo ships. It's huge. This thing is going to carry, can carry like 300 people, plus the whole hold of the ship is filled with grain. Egypt, at this time, was one of the main grain suppliers of Rome. And so we're going to have this big old monster oil tanker. No, I mean grain tanker. Whatever. This is not a little, don't think of those little boats you see in the stories of Jesus on the Sea of Galilee. Okay? We're talking a big, big thing here. Okay. He put us on this ship. And when we had sailed slowly many days, and scarce were come over against Cnidus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under Crete over against Salome. This is the part that slows everything down. When they catch this ship from Myra, they have to go along the coasts here, and then they try to make the jump out into the big ocean, out into the big city, and they're now going to sail underneath Crete and come along the coast here. But everything's really slow going. And in fact, because of the direction of the winds, they're probably tacking back and forth, just to make any little headway at all. Not compared to the first day, but they made a 65-mile shot one day. Man, they were just cooking. This trip, now this arm of it, they're really slowing down. And verse 8, "Hardly passing it, came into a place which is called the Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia." Now, and so they're gonna land the boat on the island of Crete, here on the east coast of Crete, this place called Fair Havens, right in here. It's a little bay on the island of Crete, but that's about all it is. It's just a little bay. We've got this giant ship with all these people, and they're getting towards the end of the time of year when you don't sail the Mediterranean Sea, and these guys don't like this port. I mean, there's not many places, not stuff to do in the evenings and all. And verse 9, "Now, when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them." Now, they've spent some time at this Fair Havens place. The trip has probably taken far longer than Julius was hoping for. He was hoping for good sailing, good weather. Says the fast was now already past. The fast is talking about the main Jewish fast of the year. Happens September, October, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. In AD 59, which is the year we believe this is, Yom Kippur fell in August, on October 5th. From early October to mid-March, dangerous storms in the Mediterranean. You don't sail during those times. So the fast is already passed. They're already, it's kind of like, the shuttle. They're past their window of opportunity. Julius is frustrated. And Paul admonishes them. He, what's the word? There's a word here. He exhorts. He recommends them. Recommends to them. Gives them his advice. And he said unto them, "Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage. Not only of the lading, not only of the grain that you're carrying and ship, but also our lives. I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and with much damage." The word hurt is, the Greek word is hubris. We use that word sometimes in English, talking about pride and insolence, and it causes hurt and damage. Now, as you're going to find, Paul's correct in his perception. They should have been listening to him. But he's not the most, he's probably not the most experienced sailor on board. I mean, there are guys on board that make their living doing this kind of stuff. Now, Paul does have some experience. In fact, in 2 Corinthians 11:25, he says, which he already has written, he says, "Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I have been in the deep." Now, he's already done that. So this guy's already been shipwrecked three times in his life. And so he just wants to be a little cautious, Sometimes we need to be giving a warning. Not everyone wants to hear a warning. I know that sometimes I get defensive and try to justify myself rather than listen to others' concerns. I see that in myself when somebody, is telling me I'm doing the wrong thing. I get defensive. But even if they don't want to listen, there comes a time when we still need to lovingly, carefully warn them. Gosh, Paul, remember when he was talking to the Ephesian elders in Acts 20, he talked about how I used to warn you night and day with tears. That's a good way to warn people. We can only pray that the other person will understand Proverbs 27:6 that says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but kisses of an enemy are deceitful." Sometimes we need to give a warning. Verse 11. "Nevertheless," so Paul's given his warning. He's given his 2 cents. "Nevertheless, the centurion believed or was persuaded by the master and the owner of the ship." These are two separate people. The master is the helmsman. The owner of the ship is the captain of the ship. "More than those things which were spoken by Paul." Now, it's kind of interesting. I guess here we get the idea that the guy who's really calling the shots on board is the centurion. He's the ranking officer. He's even over the guy who owns the ship, the captain of the ship. Julius is calling the shots here. And I hate to pick on poor Julius, but we're going to pick on poor Julius. But we can see in him an example of how we often make decisions. His decisions to sail is based solely upon the advice of the experts. And though this would be an appropriate way to decide much of the time, there are going to be times when it's the wrong decision. You see that here? See, Paul actually is the one who's got some insight into this thing. And yet there's this whole boatload of experts who are sure that they ought to go on. 2 points here that I want to make. One is this: experts aren't always right. Please don't misunderstand me. It is good to ask the experts and to collect all the facts. In Numbers chapter 13, when the Israelites were getting close to the Promised Land, they've been wandering through the wilderness for a couple of years, two or so years. They're getting right up to the doorway of the Promised Land. It was God's idea to send 12 spies into the land. Some people make a mistake there and think that was the wrong thing to do. No, it was God's idea to send the 12 spies into the land to find out what it was like. What happened when they came back, 10 of them gave a bad report. Two of them gave a good report. They all agreed that there were giants in the land. The question is, what do you do with that knowledge? God doesn't want you making decisions blindly, but He also doesn't want you making decisions without faith. Sometimes the right decision is the one contrary to the experts or the majority. Paul had spent some time on ships. There's a good chance that he wasn't as schooled in good sailing as the helmsman and the owner, and yet Paul was actually the correct one. Sometimes the experts or our perception of them, what we do with it, is wrong. A senior gas company training supervisor and a young trainee were out checking meters in a suburban neighborhood. They parked their truck at the end of the alley and worked their way to the other end. At the last house, a woman in her kitchen window watched the two men as they checked her gas meter. Having finished the meter checks, the supervisor challenged his younger co-worker to a foot race down the alley back to the truck, just to prove that an older guy could outrun a younger one. As they at last came running up to the truck, they forgot to check who had won, because they realized that the lady from that last house was huffing and puffing right behind them. They immediately stopped and asked her what was wrong. Gasping for breath, she said, "Well, when I saw two men from the gas company running away from my house as hard as you two were, I figured I'd better run too." Sometimes, and take this in balance, precious ones, in all our decisions. In all our decisions. And no, I'm not trying to apply this one way or the other to the building. Don't put that on me. You could apply this both ways to the building thing. You could. Very, very easily to both ways. This goes with all of our decisions. All of our decisions. Sometimes. Not all the times. I mean, probably most of the time experts are right, huh? But sometimes they're wrong. Second lesson is this. We need to leave room for faith in our decisions. Look at Hebrews chapter 11. We need to leave room for faith in our decisions. I am afraid I'm not going to give you any pat answers in making decisions, because frankly, gang, every decision's different, isn't it? Every decision is different. If I could do anything this morning, it would probably make you more uncomfortable than anything. Sometimes we come up with our little pat ways of making our decisions, and I ask person A and person B and person C, and then I collect all the data, and there you go, and that's my decision. No, it's not always that easy. You need to leave room for faith. Verse 1, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, the word of faith teachers would like to have us believe that somehow faith is some kind of a substance that you pump up into yourself. You know, if I get 20 pounds of faith, I can really twist God's arm. 30 pounds of faith, and you won't even believe what you can get God to do for you if you got 30 pounds of faith. You know what? There is nothing mystical about faith. It's not a substance. That's a misunderstanding of the Greek here. The New Living Translation says, "What is faith? It is the confident assurance that what we hope for is going to happen. It is the evidence of things we cannot yet see." Faith is trusting in the unseen. That's all it is. Don't make it some magic, twinkly, fairy dust thing. It's trusting in something you don't see. Trusting in something you don't see. Look at verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him, God. For he that cometh to God must believe that He is. Why? Because He's invisible. And if you're going to come to God, there comes a point where you're going to have to trust in someone you don't see. He that cometh to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of them
that diligently seek Him. Faith is a vital part of our relationship with God. It's not optional. God is going to be looking for our trust in Him. He will reward our trust in Him. Verse 7, by faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. See, in Noah's day, it had not yet rained. They just had this mist stuff. God had this like perpetual mist stuff. It's really cool. You know, it's just like those, probably those like those sprayers you put on your patio, you know, to cool the thing down. You know, as mist would rise up from the ground. God always does things great. You know, I would have loved to see how God pulled all this off. Hadn't rained yet. They'd never seen a rainstorm. And so the idea of a rainstorm, let alone a flood, was ridiculous. How could something we've never seen happen? Well, guess what? It did. And Noah trusted in what God told him, even though he didn't see it. That's faith. Verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out not knowing whither he went. Now, for some of us, that is unheard of. For some of us, when I go on vacation, I have maps of every street and alley that I'm going to drive in. I have reservations with confirmation numbers, charge card receipts and everything. Make sure that I've planned everything out and I know exactly what's going to happen. This guy moved his entire family and he didn't even know where he was going. Why? Because God said, go. And he went. Now see, for some of us, if you really will put yourself in that circumstance, that's uncalled for. That's not the way you and I would live our lives. And yet Abraham is the father of faith. Faith is what pleases God. Now, please, don't misunderstand me. I'm not advocating reckless abandonment to all wise counsel. But sometimes, precious ones, you have to heed the prompting God puts in your heart. And He won't give you anything to hang your hat on. You have to go for it. And you know what? God's just tickled when you do that. That's a very scary thing, though, isn't it? I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about a person who doesn't make wise decisions at all in their life. But I'm talking about there are times where we need to be shook up a little bit in the way we approach things sometimes. Leave room for faith. Make sure in your decisions you leave room for God to speak. Leave room for faith. Back to Acts. Oh man, I'm in verse 11 and I got to end in 5 minutes for communion. No problem. We're gonna get through this chapter. By faith. You don't see it. You have no idea how I'm gonna do it. Verse 12. Well, that was my biggest part of the message right there. Okay. Verse 12. So he believed, Julius made his decision based on what the experts said. Verse 12. And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, it wasn't a great place for the guys to spend the winter, the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phoenice and there to winter, which is a haven of Crete. Phoenice, or the city of Phoenix, is only 35 miles up the coast of Crete. It's only 35 miles away. Easy piece of cake sailing. Only 35 miles up that. No problem. We're just going 35 miles away. How bad can that be? and it lieth towards the southwest and the northwest, whatever that means. Verse 13, and when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sailed close to Crete. Now, they go ahead and they start their voyage, and the wind is blowing softly. And they figure, we got it made. See, we made the right decision. The evaluation of whether you made your right decision is not how well you start. It's how well you finish. It's not what it's like starting. It's how you finish. Verse 14, and not long after, there arose against it, against the ship, a tempestuous wind called Euroclydon. That sounds like a monster or something, you know, like out of a Japanese movie or something. Oh, no, Euroclydon. Huh? A tempestuous wind. We get our English word typhoon from the word that's described here. I mean, we're talking hurricanes like Mitch and all like that. The island of Crete has very high mountains. Here's this little island out on the ocean. Has mountains going up to 7,000 feet. And the wind comes rushing down into the water. And just all of a sudden will come and just sweep ships away. Verse 15, and when a ship was caught, it was seized. And it could not bear up under the wind. We let her drive. We gave up. We turned the boat around and said, okay, let's just go with this. And running under a certain island, which is called Clauda, which I don't even have that on my map, we had much work to come by the boat. Now, there's two vehicles involved here. There's the ship, and then there's a little boat, which they would use around the ship to do repairs and stuff like this. And we realized we needed to pull up the boat. And so even everybody, and you can picture, you know, Luke and Paul, everybody's a part of this. We all had to bring this boat up out of the water. And when they had taken up, they used helps, undergirding the ship. And fearing lest they should fall into the quicksands, they strake sail and so were driven. In those ships in those days, when you had bad weather, they would run extra cables underneath the ship, keeping the boards in place so the thing doesn't fall apart. It says they were fearing about, it says King James, quicksands. There were certain sandbars they knew were in the area, and they didn't want to get caught on those in the storm. And so they just let the ship go. Running, verse 18, and we, being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. The thing was sinking, and they were worried that it was riding too low in the water, so they get some of the stuff up so it could ride higher. And so they would have less of a risk of landing on a sandbar. Verse 19, and the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. You know, all the ropes and the pulleys, and they're throwing everything overboard to make the thing lighter. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. I mean, days on end go by. They don't even see the sun or the stars. They have no clue where they are. But after long abstinence, in other words, they stopped eating. I don't know whether this was because they were trying to fast to convince their gods to help them, or whether this was to try to conserve food, we're not sure. But they weren't eating for a long time. Paul stood in the midst of them and said, sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me. This is a polite way of saying, I told you so. You should have hearkened. Now, ladies, don't start using this on us, okay?
You should have hearkened unto me.
And not loosed from Crete, and to have gained this harm and loss. And now I exhort you. Now, the word that's translated exhort is the same word, it's an odd little duck of a word. It's the same word that was translated that how he admonished them the last time. So he's kind of saying, I'm going to give this one more shot. I'm going to give you one more set of instructions. Let's see how you do this time. And so now I exhort you to be of good cheer. Buck up, buckaroos. You know, cheer up. For there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. We're going to lose the ship. But not a single person will die. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve. The word he uses for serve is a religious kind of a word, talking about like how priests would offer service like sacrifices and incense and prayers in a temple. It's that word. So he's saying, the God whom I serve religiously, this is my God, an angel of God whom I serve stood by me in the night, saying, fear not, Paul. Thou must be brought before Caesar. I mean, we got something to do, bud. We got to get you to Caesar. And lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Two things here. Number one is an angel stood with him. The first thing I wanted to say is this. He's with you in the storm. He's with you in the storm. Some of you may be in some storms right now. He's with you in the storm. It may be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You're in the fire, but there is a fourth one, like the Son of God, there with you. Maybe like in Mark 4:38, where you're in the boat with the disciples, and Jesus is there, and it looks like he's sleeping in the back of the boat. But he's there. Maybe like Mark 6:48, where they're on the storm-tossed sea, and there comes Jesus walking on the water. Looks like he's going to go right by them. Oh, no. He's not going by you. He's there with you in the storm. The second lesson we want to mention real quick here is this. It says, God hath given thee all of them that sail with thee. God's given you these people, he says. God's given you these people. If God is promising to give these people to Paul, you know what that implies? That Paul has asked for them. Doesn't it? Jesus said, ask and it shall be given unto you. The implication here that Paul has been asking for them. Pray for those who are in the same boat as you. Pray for those in the same boat as you. You know, it's not hard, beloved. It's so easy when we're in the midst of a storm to be so self-concerned and so worried about me. But the picture here is that even though Paul's afraid, because he says, don't be afraid. So Paul's afraid. Even though he's afraid, he's still praying for 275 other people on board. I personally am of the opinion he's praying for them by name. Some of them may be prisoners. Some of them may be murderers condemned to death. Some of them may be those guys with that curse like a sailor, because they're sailors. Some of them may be soldiers. He's praying. He's asking God, give me these people, O God. Give me these people, O God. Pray for those in your boat. It's too often we talk far more about prayer than we actually pray. 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 Pray for those in your boat. Verse 25. Wherefore, sirs, he's continuing his encouragement. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God, that it shall be even as it was told me. Paul told them to be encouraged. Why? Because he believed in God. Had nothing to even to do whether they believed in God. Oh, let's get a praise worship meeting going. Let's all pump up our faith. We get enough faith, we will float. We just get enough faith, you know. You know what? He says, don't worry, guys. I am trusting God. I believe in God. Can you say that to your friends? Wow. Wow. Verse 26. Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island. He's been given that instruction. An island's going to pop up. We're going to land on it. You know, we'll be finished with this three-hour tour. But there's going to be a funny guy with a white hat and go, oh, skipper. No, sorry. Sorry.
Verse 27. And when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down in Adris, the name of the sea, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country. They could tell they're getting close to shore. And they sounded and found it 20 fathoms. That's, they drop a line with a lead weight on it. And they 20 fathoms. A fathom is 6 feet. So 80 feet, the depth of the water is 80 feet. And when they gone a little further, I'm sorry, not 80 feet, 120 feet. When they went a little further, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. Now it's only 90 feet deep. They figure, at the rate we're going, we're going to be run aground real quick. And then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast four anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. We're praying for the day to come. And as the shipmen were about to flee of the ship, when they had let down the boat, that's the little boat, into the sea, under the color or under the guise of as though they were to have cast anchors out from the front of the ship. We're not going anywhere. We're just going into the boat. We're going to get into the boat and just put more anchors out. Yes, we are. Cross our heart. We're not going anywhere, honestly. Yeah, right. Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, Paul's watching all this, and he says, except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved. You let these guys get in the boat, we're goners. Now, I don't know if there's really some super spiritual, cosmic, mystical advice here. It's like, you know, if we don't have enough guys on the boat, you know, we will... No. That's not the point. The sailors know how to sail the thing. Okay? If the sailors are gone, who's going to run the boat? Who knows how to steer this tub, you know? You let these guys go, we will die for sure. Don't let them go. As I was studying, well, some of you may have already been up with me on this, but as I was studying, I couldn't help but think that there might be some who would be looking at this chapter as some kind of an omen against the church moving to a new building. We're headed for a shipwreck! They might be tempted to cry. And you know what? Honestly, I can't refute that as a legitimate possibility. Oh, no, wait a minute. I didn't want to hear you say that. I'm being honest. But the truth is, we're not going to know that until it happens. I mean, you could also legitimately argue that we're already in a shipwreck here. I mean, the air conditioning don't work and the place is flooded and whatever. But no matter how you look at it, the lesson is this. Don't abandon ship. Don't abandon ship. We're all a part of this. We're part of each other. We belong to each other. We belong to each other. Abandoning ship is no way to go through life, but sadly, this is how some operate. The wife burns the toast one too many times, and it's next! Find the next wife! If you haven't found out already, if you're looking for the perfect church, I got news for you. You might as well move on, because this ain't it. This is not the perfect church. You're going to find real people here, people who make mistakes, people who say things they wish they'd never said, people who unintentionally hurt other people's feelings. But growing up in life, precious ones, is learning about being gracious, loving, and kind and forgiving to one another. That's what it's all about. Don't abandon ship. Verse 32, then the soldiers cut off the ropes off the boat and let her fall off. So see, these guys are getting this boat ready, you know, and it's hanging there over to the sides, and they go, okay, whoosh, and they cut all the ropes, and they just dump the boat. Guess who's in charge now? Who's calling the shots? Paul is. Paul says, you let these guys go. We're goners. The soldiers say, yes, sir. And they cut the ropes. Interesting, huh? How things turn around. Verse 33, and while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take meat, to eat some, saying, this day is the 14th day that you have tarried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. I mean, anything for 14 days. Wherefore, I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health, for there shall not a hair fall from the head of any of you.
And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Almost sounds a little bit like communion, doesn't it? Which we're going to have in just a second here. And Paul may have been thinking of communion, but these guys don't know about it. But you know what he's doing? He's encouraging them by his example. He doesn't just say, oh, just go eat something, but I can't really handle anything right now. No, he sets the example. Howard Hendricks says, you can impress people at a distance, but you can impact them only up close. It's your example that will impact them. And so he eats in verse 36. Then when they all were of good cheer, they also took some meat. They all ate, well, actually it's grain that they're taken from the ship. And we were all in the ship 216 souls. That's 276 people. And when we had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. This is the cargo. They're tossing the rest of the cargo overboard. And when it was day, they knew not the land. They couldn't recognize the island. It was Malta. But they couldn't recognize it. But they discovered a certain creek, or actually literally a bay, with a shore, into which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in their ship. And when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves into the sea and loosed the rudder bands. Not rubber bands. Look at that long time thing. They loosed the rubber bands. Okay. Is that how these things worked? Okay. And they hoisted up the mainsail. Hoist the mainsail, mateys, to the wind, and made toward shore. And falling into a place where the two seas met, currents crashing together, they ran the ship aground, and the forepart stuck fast. The front sticks in the sand and remained unmovable, with the hinder part broken with the violence of the waves. So the front part is stuck, and the back part starts falling apart with the waves crashing against it. And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. Because you see, the rules of the Roman army are, if you're guarding a prisoner, if he gets away, you take his place. They didn't want to do that. So let's kill these people before whatever. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, I love this, kept them from their purpose and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and to get to land, and the rest, some on board, some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they all escaped, all safe to the land. Isn't that awesome? Just as God promised, just as Paul prayed. Let's pray and prepare our hearts for communion. Lord, such exciting stories in your precious holy word. Such adventures Paul was on. Amazing, Lord. Lord, we want to grow in being men and women of faith, learning to trust you. We want to hear your voice. We want to know you. We want to follow after you. I pray, Lord, in Jesus' name, for any of my brothers and sisters here who are in the midst of a storm right now. And Father, I would pray in Jesus' precious name that you would encourage them, that you would show them that they're not alone, that you would hold their hand, pour out your love on them, Lord. Those who've lost all hope, oh Lord, there's hope in you. There's hope in your love for us. Help us to cling to you. In Jesus' name, amen.